Right? Like most people go through their day while having like zero people tell them to go fuck themselves. I get a lot of people telling me to go fuck myself on any given day.
Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name's Rob Farley, and today with me is Scott Lemieux and Matthew Iglesias. This is the first of a what we hope will be a series on the oral history of the blogosphere. We are absolutely delighted to have you today, Matt. It's always an honor to have you around Lawyers, Guns, and Money in some fashion, and I'm just delighted you could join us.
Glad to be here. It's old-time blogs.
Absolutely. The best. the last survivor.
Right. So I guess I'm gonna throw out sort of the very first question here. Way back when did you start blogging and why did you start blogging?
Oh man. Okay, so in the summer of 2001, I was an intern for Chuck Schumer's communications director. And my main responsibility there was to get clips of Chuck Schumer being mentioned in the media. At the time, this mostly involved looking at physical newspapers from throughout New York State and literally cutting them with scissors. And then I didn't actually paste them anywhere. I just used a photocopier. But we did some limited internet search. And it was through that I think I found Mickey Kaus's blog. And then through Mickey, I found Josh Marshall and Andrew Sullivan. And I kind of liked those websites. And when I went back to school that fall, 9/11 happened, which led, I mean, literally on my first day back on campus. And that led to a huge surge of interest in blogs and blogging. My roommate was a computer science major, so he helped me set up a blog. I didn't know at the time, and neither did he, that there was such a thing as blogging software. So we were like using the campus build a website tools, and I was like hard coding HTML to make posts. Then I eventually found out about Blogger, and it was sort of off to the races from there.
And my very first reaction to that is, oh Christ, we're gonna have to interview Mickey Kaus at some point. I don't know if I can.
The original.
Yeah. So anyway, go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, one of the weirdest trajectories in the history of the blogosphere too. But anyway, so it was the first. So obviously, you know, you blogged throughout your university years. You know, and I'm not really going to bring up the Iraq stuff, which I've always thought, you know, that this is something that sort of your critics have always come back to, which is, you know, like a college student was against the, you know, was in favor of the war. And I think you repudiated your support more or less on the eve of the war. It wasn't, you know, we weren't exactly Glenn Reynolds. But you know, that, you know, I think that's been discussed enough. But was your first professional, it was with TAP, right? Was your first professional blogging?
Yeah, I'll say if people are interested in a really lengthy discussion of Iraq, I was on Julia Galef's podcast and we talked about this in great detail if you want to hear. Yes, but so I was blogging for a couple of years as a student and then, you know, I was graduating and I needed a job and I did not have a super clear idea of what I wanted to do in life. I was tempted by the idea of applying to PhD programs, but it seemed reckless to just apply to philosophy PhD programs, you know, with no real sense of the world.
I hate to disagree with you, but, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, so I was not looking for a career. I was looking for like a job to do that seemed interesting while I thought about things. And I applied to a bunch of different stuff. But one of them was a writing fellowship at the American Prospect where, I think Richard Just and Nick Confessori, who were working there at the time, they were, cause like the internet wasn't really in 2003, like magazines had websites, but the thing to do was to write print articles. The web was like an annoying task that the bosses were dabbling in. And so a couple of the people there who were involved in the website, I think were excited about an applicant who actually wanted to write for the web. You know, so I went there and I did that. And I worked at the American Prospect for a couple of years. And I think that was really actually like a quite formative experience in a lot of ways. I learned a lot from Michael Tomasky and Bob Kuttner and Harold Meyerson, and sort of that generation's now kind of old-fashioned, like labor-liberal perspective on American politics and American political history, which, you know, I wasn't like unfamiliar with, but you don't know that much when you're 21, 22, you know, particularly about like how things were in the past and like what fights did people have in the 80s. And so it was really working in that small newsroom that I learned a lot about politics.
Now, you were still there, at least for a bit, after Scott and I joined TAP, I think. And I think I was there for 3 years. And Scott, you were there for longer, right?
Yeah, and I still remember, our friend Sam Rosenfeld, who, of course, now he did take the academic route. But he, you know, the amazing thing to me is that I owe my very small amount of prominence in the liberal opinion world to Sam discovering my blogging about Sam Alito. And my point was that, you know, contrary to the conventional wisdom of the media, he would, you know, be extremely conservative and worse than Scalia, which is sort of like being, you know, paid to argue that water is wet, except that this is, I guess it's the thing that you always get into mad about, what's a contrarian position, because in terms of the opinions being put out there, it was contrarian, but in terms of the facts, it was like plain as day. And so Sam hired me for a couple articles, and then at some point brought beyond as a freelance TAP. And I still remember meeting with Sam and Matt and Ezra at that bar in DC that had the great looking beer menu, 95% of which was always out of stock.
Oh yeah, the late lamented Brick Skeller.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I think I was there a little bit before you. But that was really, I mean, you know, and I've already mentioned Ezra, but really that was TAP during that period, and for a little longer that really was an incredible generator of talent, because you know the next generation was included Jamel Bowie, Adam yeah, I actually had a talk with Adam one time visiting. It was, I think, not surprising how well he's turned out, and so it really was quite remarkable, you know. And it's particularly remarkable this came up, you know, because I think the magazine was also sort of ambivalent about the blogging side. Like, I was there when TAP was just dismantled for casually for no reason whatsoever, you know, despite being a great blog. So what, you know, what was that? It was a really interesting place. Like, what was it like to actually work there full time? Because it was really a place where a lot of major writers got started.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting. You know, I overlapped with Sam, who, you know, as you say, has gone into academia, but I think was actually like a sneakily influential person in journalism, because a lot of talent came through there. And I think not a lot of people realize that, but, you know, so I overlapped with Sam, with Ezra Klein and with Ann Friedman,
that's right.
You know, who is another very influential media person. Adam Serwer and Jamel Bowie came after me, as did Dana Goldstein, but I knew them, socially and intellectually, and was, I think, you know, helped encourage Adam to apply in that. And it was a great investment. I hope that the people who were the donors to the magazine during this really great 10-year run of recruiting and training very influential media people acknowledge that there was value in that. Right. That, you know, I don't think the Prospect ever had huge reach as a publication, but it's had enormous influence as a sort of crucible of talent. You know, in terms of what you wrote about Alito, I mean, Sam and I had this like broader idea that we called the like counterintuitive journalism, because just an inherent bias of media is to, and I think academic work is like this too, is that like you're supposed to be original, right? So it's like, you don't want to just say like, oh, the Beatles are good. Right. And one of the pieces, I think this was a piece we commissioned from you, Scott, but was like Roe v. Wade being overturned would be bad.
Yeah, that's the most money I've ever been paid for an article to this day.
It holds up great, but it's so funny that that was like a discussion was like, should a progressive magazine run a piece saying that it would be bad for conservatives to achieve one of their most long-held, like, not subtle policy ideas, right? But it was so overwhelmingly popular at that time to construct these admittedly more clever arguments, like these, like, bank shoddy things. Right. But
like abolishing the Air Force, for example.
Yeah, well,
that's crazy.
But yeah, but you know, there is room for like out there takes, and you know, whether it's expanding the Overton window or just surprising people, et cetera, et cetera. But there's always just also like a room in life, I think, for the reassertion of sort of like basic, fairly obvious points, because there's a big structural incentive to be weird all the time.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know, and that's, you know, with the sort of contrarian phase of media, like there's a grain of truth to it, you know, that, you know, sort of, you know, an idea you haven't heard before is more interesting than one that you have. But I think that the attempt to construct a narrative or overturning Roe is no big deal sort of just shows all the pathologies of that, you know, of that approach. You know, that, you know, in particular, that, you know, the contrarianism often tends to go in particular directions. And I think the punchline in my article was all these arguments ultimately come down to the premise that reproductive freedom is really no big deal. You know, they're always sort of like, it'll be politically good for Democrats, or, you know, who cares about women in Alabama? And there's also an unstated thing, like, you know, people I know are not going to be strongly affected by this. And so I think that was a larger, you know, that was sort of, you know, a potential problem, is that, you know, the contrarianism of that era, you know, tended much more, would be much more likely to sort of, you know, lean to the right than lean to the left. You know, and sort of tended to reflect conventional wisdom in some deeper sense.
And I think it also actually suppressed what was the real argument, right? Like, so like a piece saying, I don't really think that the reproductive freedoms of low-income women who live in conservative states is that important. I don't think I would agree with that, but that's an idea. I mean, not everything can be the most important thing. It is completely appropriate to have debates about which things are important and which things are less important. But if you frame it in this contrarian way, like, actually it'll be good, it actually masks like what is the thing that we are arguing about, which is the relative significance of these different subjects in a hierarchy of priorities. And I think that in a totally different way, this is something that Democrats are really struggling with at the moment as they try to shape a legislative agenda, which is that, you know, it's the American political system is like just not that friendly to passing laws. You know, it's really unlikely that you're going to make major policy change on 20 different fronts simultaneously. So it really matters actually like a lot what you decide is the most important thing and what you decide is like a nice to have. And it's very impolite, right? Like people want to, we're human beings and we would rather get along with each other and be like, you know, post the why not both GIF and all kinds of other stuff like that. But you know, you got to, raising taxes is challenging. Small minorities are difficult. There's a lot of veto points in the system, and what you pick and choose, you know, it matters.
Yeah, and before I turn back over to Rob, like, you've been making that point about the Build Better Back Act, and I think that's correct. Although, you know, pointing out that it'd be better to do fewer things better is sort of, you know, very logical in the abstract, but a lot harder to pull off politically. You know, whereas Republicans are just comfortable with government by judiciary, you know, the Democrats are a coalition, and you know that actually matters.
No, it's
too,
hard.
So I want to drag us back, sort of to the more blogging part of the conversation. So, did you ever have any sense, like, of how many? So, by the time I started even paying attention to blogs, you were a big name in the blog world. How much do you now, or how much have you ever paid attention to traffic, right? I mean, now you pay attention to it because you're Substack and it is literally goes into your livelihood. But way back in the day, like, how much did you obsess about how many people were reading you?
In the blog days, I did not pay a ton of attention to readership metrics because it had no real meaning, you know? I mean, you know, and the blogosphere was very conversational, and, you know, so I was interested in, like, were people responding? Were people saying nice things about the post, et cetera, et cetera? I would say peak metrics was when I was working at Slate, which Slate did not have some, like, traffic-based compensation system or anything like that, but they did push out individual metrics to writers as an informational thing on a daily basis. And, you know, I was just wanted to have good stats instead of bad ones. And I would see, you know, in most months, either I or Will Arenas would be on top, you know, and I wanted to beat him. But sometimes Dave Weigel would beat us. Or sometimes random freelance piece would go insane, you know, and blow everybody out of the water. At Vox, like, I was in a management role for some time, in which case you have to try to really understand the metrics. In some ways, the better you understand them, the less emphasis you might put on them in some ways. Then the economic model, while I was at Vox, started to shift away from display advertising. So the raw traffic numbers became a less significant thing to follow. You know, at Substack, of course, I track my subscribership numbers very closely, but that's different from a traffic measure, you know, along a lot of different dimensions. So I have less stress.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. That's really the point about traffic and paid subscribers. But I want to try to do it somewhat chronologically. I wanted to ask you your time at Slate, because it was kind of interesting in that, you know, most of your career, you know, you've sort of been a generalist and you've sort of prided yourself and defended that, you know, there's room for kind of experts, but there's also room for somebody who just, you know, tries to make sense of a lot of things and communicates that to readership. And Slate was the one place where you were kind of put into a silo, doing the Moneybox column. And I always got the sense from the outside that was maybe a touch uncomfortable for you, that it wasn't really a natural fit. Was that kind of your idea, that you wanted to try something new, or was that something that was proposed to you by Plotz or whoever else hired you at Slate or something?
No, I mean, so what happened at Slate was Slate had this round of layoffs that was really tough. I mean, I think it was a tough experience for everybody who was at the company. And they lost a couple of politics writers in those layoffs. They sort of pundit types, you know, went away. Then shortly after those layoffs, Annie Lowrey, who had been the Moneybox columnist, she got hired at the New York Times. So I came to Slate with the proposition that they should hire me, that I write in a much higher volume than the people who'd been laid off and then the person who had left for another job, and that I could sort of do like all of those roles. I wanted to work at Slate, basically, and I talked them into the idea that I could fill this hole that they had in their editorial agenda. And it was never, like, it wasn't awkward. Like, I had a couple meetings with David Plotz and with Josh Levine and other editors there, Julia Turner, and, you know, they agreed, and I was very happy to do the job. But it was on both sides, like, mashing of a bit of a square peg into a round hole kind of thing. What was great about Slate at that time, I don't want to say it's not like that now, I just don't work there anymore, but was that Slate was very creative, you know, editorially, in terms of who did what and what kinds of pieces they would run. So, you know, I would just publish things that were in different sections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I liked about that was that I was pushed to do some business stories that didn't have a strong policy angle, which just, like, I've read different books and I talked to some different people and I learned some different things from what I've been doing elsewhere in my career. And I did think that was interesting, just the actual dynamics of businesses and how they think about making decisions is an interesting subject.
Now, I can't remember if it was directly after, but after Slate came the Center for American Progress, right?
No, Center for American Progress was before Slate.
Oh, that was before Slate.
And then we started Vox. Right. Center for American Progress, I had a great time working at Think Progress and with the team there. But that, I think, was just not tenable. CAP is a very political institution, like for good reason. And that was like not a great fit ultimately for me and what I had to do. I was glad to leave CAP voluntarily on good terms with all of the people involved. Right. I think some other people, I think, you know, friends of yours, like Matt Duss, kept working there past the point where a lot of ill will was generated by what was really not anybody doing anything wrong. It was just, you can't both be like the in-house think tank for the Democratic Party establishment and also be like really free thinking and honest on every policy area under the sun. Like it doesn't work, you know? And it's too bad, but I liked the people who I worked with there. And I liked my bosses there too, frankly. It was just a basic conflict of the roles.
Right. And so then it's after, and then, I mean, you mentioned Vox before, but you know, there's sort of a, you know, you're moving up to being a street level dealer, and then, you know, you're sliding yeah. up the hierarchy. So what was it like being in that kind of management position? I mean, that would have to be
terrible.
Something new.
You that didn't was like it. That was a catastrophe. You know, I think a big issue in media is that almost all of the management is done by former writers. And a lot of them are not good at it. And I observed that fact and came to the conclusion that what that meant is that I would be better at it than these other assholes. But in fact, I was just worse. I was just part of the problem that I had correctly identified. I found it incredibly stressful to be in management. And one distinction I want to make is editing is not my passion in life. But I do like it. I like working with writers, particularly younger writers, on trying to make pieces better. But the difference between being called in as like a one-off editor and being an editor at a publication is that as the manager, you're not just like the steward of the article, right? And like you try to make the lead better or clarify something. You're the steward of a person's career, like a human being. Right. So you have to give them feedback in a way that they will take seriously, but not find utterly devastating. You have to calibrate your emotional reactions to the actual situation, not like I'm stressed out because my plumbing is broken and now I'm lashing out at you. Do you guys have kids?
I do.
Yeah. So, you know, this is what's hard about parenting, right? Is that like you need to ideally like react to what the kids do in like an objectively correct way, not in a way that just like brings all your other stresses and stuff to the table, but it's hard, right? It's like sometimes just like, because I didn't get a good night's sleep, I'm like, and it's to do that as your job as well as a dad is like, it's too much.
Yeah. And that's, well, and academia has the same problem that like, you know, administrators are just promoted from, you know, there's really nothing about being a teacher and and researcher that necessarily means you'll be a good administrator, but that's
right. Your research is great. Yeah. Now supervise grant proposals. And it's
right. Like, yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Even my sister left, you know, her job as a chemical engineer, because to get ahead in the corporation where she worked, she was going to have to be some kind of management role. She just had no interest in that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and because she's really good with money, it, you know, the it wasn't worth that to her. So, you know, there's got to be, I'm sure there's lots of good stuff written about, you know, the sort of the failure to take sort of management and administration seriously in some places as just different things, you know, which should be sort of, you know, and they often come with more money, but, you know, kind of less prestige. And there's also this assumption that, you know, you sort of, you know, you need to sort of go up and do something other than what you're good at. But it is, you know, striking in your case that you sort of, you know, were able to sort of step back and say, this isn't what I want to do, and sort of went back to writing, even when you're still at Vox. And because you were not only manager, but co-founder, right? Like that was.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it was a tough call, but I mean, I think it's important to try to be honest with yourself about like what you're good at and what you want to do in life. You know, and it was honestly like, so Vox turned out pretty well, I think. And, you know, it was a good publication and we had a lot of good people there and we ran a lot of good stuff. But to be 100% frank, like Ezra and Melissa and I had some, like, we had some like wild ideas that like didn't pan out. Like we were, we thought that like everybody's doing this all wrong, and like they're not doing it all wrong. Right. And what wound up being strong about Vox was just like we had some good people on the team, but what they and this is still true now. I mean, you read Vox, and it is a good publication that has some good writers and some good editors, and has a great video program and good podcasts. But it's not like a totally different style of journalism, right? And what made me interested in leaving Slate to found Vox in the first place was the idea that we were gonna like, you know, be disruptor, that we were gonna do something like really different. And I think Vox turned out to be like another worthy entrant in the digital media space, but not one that is incredibly distinctive from the Atlantic or Slate or anything else that people are doing out there. And that's not on, to be clear, like this is not a knock on the people who are there. This is a knock on me, like our idea for what would be a good idea for like a drastically different kind of publication did not, like it wasn't correct.
The bit about editors and bloggers is really interesting to me, right? Because I think I was fortunate enough that during the early period, which so going back to the aughts, I did have the experience of having a couple of good editors, right? I mean, so there was Phoebe, she was a good editor for a lot of stuff. Sam, of course, at World Politics Review, Judah Grunstein. And of course, you know this because, you know, you made the same transition from being a blogger who, you know, was not edited to being someone who was edited. There are other bloggers of note who have struggled to make the transition to, you know, having edited pieces, right? Like you're back now in a position where you're not edited, right? I mean, you are now sort of just back out there, right? So that does that make you feel like it's the Wild West again, or
oh no, I mean that's not the case. I have an editor who works with me and a
oh really
copy
okay
editor.
Interesting.
Now what's different is that I would say I am the boss of, so you know, because there's, I mean, I was talking about the difference between like the editor as manager and the editor as like the editor of the piece, right? Mm-hmm. And in a traditional editing setup, the editor is the boss and the writer is the employee. At Slow Boring, it's more that I'm the boss and the editors work for me, which is a difference of dynamic. But I think that if you talk to the people who've edited me, either at Slow Boring or previously, I'm a very easy edit. I'm not somebody who is picky about like words and things like that. And I like working with editors. I don't adhere to, I'm not 100% sure if like what Glenn Greenwald was reputed to have said about editing or whatever is even what he really meant, or something like that. But I know, for example, Andrew Sullivan, right, who is, you know, who I worked with at The Atlantic briefly and who I know a little bit socially on and off, like he is really a prickly guy, right? Like as a personality, totally separate from, you know, ideas or politics or ideology or stuff like that. And he really wants to be like on his own island. I'm a strong-willed person who likes to say what I think, but I also like, I like working with other people and stuff like that. I mean, I think that's good. I'm not here to be a weirdo sitting in my basement alone, even though that's in fact what I do.
Are you communicating from your basement right now?
I am.
Your basement.
I'm in the basement.
Yeah. As am I. Yes, we now live in a townhouse, so yes, I can actually blog from a basement now. It's pretty exciting. I was you because there were a couple other spots. So you mentioned that you worked briefly for The Atlantic, and I believe you also worked for a kind of major figure in the blogosphere, Josh Marshall, if I'm not correct. And Josh is interesting in that, you know, in some ways, you know, he's actually built a relatively successful media enterprise and remained prominent. The interesting thing about Josh was that he was sort of never interested in sort of, he never strongly thought himself as part of the blogosphere. And again, it's a sort of a classic dynamic of American politics that sort of right-wing bloggers were always very conscious about trying to promote each other and lift each other up. You know, Josh just, you know, he, you know, and there were people and you know, our friend Duncan, you know, played a big role in promoting us, but you know, like Josh basically had, you know, he had links to, you know, Mickey Kouse and Marshall Whitman, you know, honestly, you know, and just didn't really talk about other writers. You know, so he was sort of an interesting, I think an interesting figure in a lot of ways, but what was it like sort of being part of the kind of Talking Points Memo family and being part of that for a while?
You know, I mean, Josh is great. And I think was a really smart person about media and about politics and things like that. But yeah, I mean, he, well, for one thing, he has a very sort of like mainstream ideological view. And I think sort of always has, right? So he never had, a lot of times people do things in digital media in part because they have like political objections to other people whose media properties are already well established and things like that. Josh is like a normal Democratic Party politics has never been like, you know, you can't say that on cable television, you know, that kind of thing, right? He just like, he fell into it. I don't know 100% exactly why he started TPM, but so I think he never quite loved that like rhetoric of the blogosphere that was very rightward focused originally, as, you know, we're going to take down the liberal MSM. But, you know, he also, I think, blog was like the idea that we had back then, but he always wanted to run a small digital magazine, right? Which like is what TPM is. Right. And it just sort of wasn't like a concept that existed at that time. It would have cost him like $1 billion to start putting out a monthly print magazine that then also had a website. So like he just did the website version of like Josh Marshall's magazine about politics, which today, if you go read it, it's like totally, like it makes perfect sense. You're like, okay, there's a website with articles about politics. But back then people were like, aha, you got a blog there, son. And he's like, no, I hate that word, right? I'm no blogger. You know, I'm hiring other people. We're doing investigative pieces, you know, all this other kind of stuff. So I think it was a little bit of a, you know, a kind of an odd, process for him on that level. But you know, I learned a lot from him about the media business over the years and how he thinks about it. And he's been very successful at avoiding like hubris and overreach while still having a thing that's like good and, you know, has a team and has grown.
Right. So kind of related to all these questions that we've been asking about the different places you've been, how much of your stuff, do you have an archive of all of the different blogs? Do you have control of all of this stuff, or is some of it just out there lost to history and lost?
No, it's gone. I mean, it's on the Wayback Machine, I think. No. But I'm not an archivist of these kinds of things, and you know, I try to delete my tweets regularly, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, blog is not really a thing anymore, but I love Twitter and I loved blogging. And I think there is something to be said for the idea of ephemeral media. I mean, there's something to be said for the idea of long-lasting media, where it's like, go back and read this in 10 years and like tell me if it holds up, right? And like, absolutely, like give me shit if like these forecasts were all awful. But I think that there should be a space for people to voice ideas without that level of extreme accountability, because I think, you know, there's one problem of like pundits not taking themselves seriously enough and being like, is this really true? Can I like really stand behind this? Do I ever look back and ask whether my ideas hold up? This kind of like classic like newspaper columnist disease. But there's also a realm in which like just nobody ever wants to say anything. Because you might be like, oh, that aged poorly. But, you know, that's life, right? Like, we have reactions to things as they happen. And I think it's good to have, you know, a form of sort of, people can talk, right? Like, the social aspect of social media, or the old conversational aspect of the blogging world, just like, you know, in academia, right? Like, you guys have, like, I don't know, like the seminar, right? Where you present the draft and everybody talks about it. And that's different from like the book, right? But you're not going to get like a good book if you never discuss your ideas with anybody, for fear that it's like going to be in your permanent record.
Right. Sort of related to this, and I'd wanted to ask you about this. I mean, well, I will set something out and see if you agree with it. There are ways in which you are famously thick-skinned, right? That sort of you take, and this related to the Iraq War stuff and so forth. But you take a lot of criticism, most of which, from my point of view, is pretty unfair. But just the existence of all that criticism going all the way back from 2001. I mean, I guess I think that's why you're still in the business, right? Is you can take that kind of criticism and still sort of be in stride with it in ways that a lot of other people can't. I mean, so how have you been able to manage, you know, every rando when you say something on Twitter, you give like 32 replies, all of which are talking about how neoliberal you were and how you supported the Iraq War or something along those lines?
I don't know. I mean, I guess like I always put this the other way to younger writers and people who are trying to make it in this business. And it's like, do you want to be a successful person writing in political commentary? Because if you do, a lot of people are going to yell at you if you become successful, because that's what happens. And also to become noteworthy, you have to say stuff that's different from what your peers are all saying. Not to say that you need to be reflexively contrarian, right? But like on any given morning, there's 100 different articles you could write. If you choose out of that 100, the one that you know 7 of your colleagues are pitching, like it's not gonna work. And like that's fine. Like not every line of work is well suited to everybody. But if you're not interested in being disputatious, which is going to make people mad at you, and then it becoming successful, which is going to make haters like throw old grudges at you, then like, what are you trying to do exactly in this realm? You know, of course, like I wish everybody was polite to me all the time, you know, whatever else. And I do think that like some people from the print era are just like shocked by first email and then blogs and then social media and finding out that, you know, if you write something that 500,000 people read and 99% of them love it, but then 1% of the 1% of people who didn't love it decide that they want to tell you that they didn't like it in a vulgar way. Well, that means you're getting dozens of vulgar responses, right? Which can be a lot, right? Like most people go through their day while having like zero people tell them to go fuck themselves. I get a lot of people telling me to go fuck myself on any given day, but it's like actually a very small fraction of the audience, right? And you just like, you have to keep it in perspective in that sense, right? Like there's no possible way you could send something out to hundreds of thousands of people and they're all going to be like, what a genius, you know, like you're flawless, right? Even if your work was flawless, but also my work's not flawless. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. And that's always been the sort of annoying contradiction about, you know, a lot of the discourse around, you know, campus, you know, cancel culture, whatever, is that, you know, there's sort of a bunch of writers who on the one hand are, you know, these special snowflakes with their trigger warnings, they can't handle ideas. But then, you know, say, you know, if Brett Stevens does a name search and finds that you said something negative, you know, he'll like write a column comparing you to Nazis. You know, so there's, you know, that, you know, I remember, you know, and all these Crooked Timber people have disowned me for premature anti-Greenwaldism or something. But Daniel Davies wrote, you know, his last great blog posts about how, like, you know, I think contrarianism is great, but the thing about being a contrarian is that, like, you can't whine. Like, you can't intentionally provoke a response and then, you know, complain because people have been provoked. You know, sort of that's, you know, that if this is your game, you need to own it. And I've always thought there was sort of too little of that, you know, that there's a role, to some degree of somebody who's sort of willing to say unpopular things among their audience, but it sort of becomes unseemly then to sort of complain that people have been provoked by what you've written.
Yeah. I mean, the only, I guess, not pushback, but addendum that I would put to that is that I see that exact problem coming from sort of almost like omnidirectionally, right? That part of what we have in digital culture, right, is there's like, there's way fewer barriers. And, you know, I don't know, like I thought the 1619 Project was a really interesting provocation, right? But that's clearly what it was, right? Like it was a provocative effort to reframe American history. So then you can't act like gobsmacked that like the school boards in the more conservative parts of the country are going to be like, hey, no, this is bad, right? Because it would have been incredibly boring to write a like special issue on the Black role in American history that everybody was like, oh, this is correct, I completely agree with it, right? Like that would have been sucky. So you like you do a provocation, right? And then like, yeah, people get provoked. And absolutely, it's the same with like if you are a New York Times op-ed page conservative and like your job is to like stir the pot, then like, yeah, people are going to yell at you. And you can't be like, ah, they're trying to silence me. Because A, they're not trying to silence you. B, like that's your job, is to provoke them and get yelled at. And then it's like a management question, right? Like, does it actually make sense in the digital media era to have conservative op-ed columnists who exist to stir the pot? Or can you say, look, our opinion section has a viewpoint. I think an educated person should also read some conservative writers, but they're just going to be like in a different publication. Because, you know, the print world, right, has this kind of like our band could be your life spirit. Like you're only supposed to subscribe to one newspaper. So the newspaper itself has to contain a broad range of perspectives, or else you're going to be a narrow-minded person. But I don't find it challenging to like find libertarian writers or like weird neo-fascist writers or communists, or, you know, it's like there's all kinds of writers on the internet. If I'm going to like pay money to a publication, though, I would like kind of like it to be a congenial publication whose values I want to like support with my dollar.
So I want to drag this a little bit back to sort of meta-blogospheric conversation. And when I've been thinking about this, I think to myself and I wonder, when exactly did the blogosphere die, right? And part of that question is, part of the answer to that is it hasn't, right? Because Lawyers Guns and Money is still around, right? Eschaton is still around, right? These sorts of things. But if you were forced to answer that question, or at least to name some of the big inflection points in the history of the blogosphere, you know, what would you say that those were?
I feel like I really only have one. And it is, there was a certain point at which I was working at Slate at the time. And I, among other things, was writing a blog. But I realized that like my workflow was post is done, get the link, do a tweet about the blog, and pay a lot of attention to the reaction on Twitter to the blog post that I just wrote. And at that point, what you're really doing is you're tweeting. You know, like Twitter is where the conversation is happening. And you could just write a tweet thread, or you could screenshot the whole thing and go post it there, right? And it's like the conversation has moved out of the blogosphere and onto Twitter, which doesn't mean I stopped writing blog posts or that other people stopped writing blog posts or that I completely gave up on the idea of communicating at longer than 280 characters. But it meant that, you know, whatever you were doing, if you were just someone who's really interested in ideas and discussion and dissemination, like Twitter is where that happened. And I think that that's still true today, right? That, I mean, if you are not trying to run a business, but you just care about your writing and your ideas and how people react to them, and if you can persuade anyone or if you can be persuaded that you were wrong, like Twitter is where that is occurring, in some ways for better and in some ways for worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's almost a distinction between blogs and the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. You know, the sort of blogosphere of the sort of first, doesn't really exist as a thing anymore. Even we've taken a lot of that conversation on Twitter, but there is a way in which blogging has survived, and it's interesting because sort of people in the who are kind of part of the sort of Gawker Deadspin universe are sort of very proud to call their posts blogs. Wherever they write, that's not seen as a bad thing. We have this, this blog, I would say that, essentially Substack is just, a return to blogging. If not, again, there are some, I know a lot of, particularly people who have enough money, do have editors like you do, but it's still fundamentally, kind of blogging is essentially the format. Do you see it that way? Or do you think that there's sort of critical differences between, sort of what you do at Substack and what you would do at a kind of old fashioned blog?
I think that what I do on Substack has a lot of the spirit of blogging in it. I have a lot of that blogging DNA in me. Also as somebody, as you guys know, who, real bloggers, like, it's quite different. Like, I publish on a schedule. The posts are long. If I have something to say that's brief, I will just tweet it. I don't do it as a post. And it's definitely not, I think the distinction between blogs and the blogosphere is really good, that like there's not a lot of discussion going back and forth. I do respond to things other people write on other Substacks, but I also respond to tweets and to newspaper columns and magazine articles. There's not a distinct sphere around it. And it doesn't have that medium that the blogosphere, I think, was a kind of proto-social media, and it was outcompeted technologically by different platforms that are easier to use and have better sharing tools and give people that like quick, rapid response feedback. Because I loved blogging and because that's where I got my start in my career, I will always associate my Substack posting with a kind of a blog style thing. And what is true is that I have, once in a blue moon, I have just written something up quickly and posted it. Like, I have the ability to do that. Because the software is actually quite similar to, it is a conceptual descendant of blogging software on that level, and is built for that kind of one user could do it, write, post, go kind of stuff, which is different from some CMSs out there.
That's really interesting. I have often thought about sort of why LGM still exists and what social purpose LGM still serves. Our traffic numbers as high as they have ever been. I have increasingly come to the conclusion that really our social purpose is primarily to provide a space for our commenters to talk to one another. Right, that most of the reasons is that it is just a specific community of people who have been talking to one another for the last 15 years and who want to continue to talk to one another with the grist that we throw up. It's also, and I've mentioned this at Scott before, it's fascinating to me the percentage of our traffic that still comes from the link that Duncan Black has up on Atrios or on Eschaton. Right, it's just we get almost as much as we get from Twitter. We get from just people clicking on the Lawyers, Guns, and Money link on the blog roll at Eschaton blog, which is just crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of blogs that are still out there. I mean, I don't know. I haven't done like a sociological deep dive into Eschaton readership, but I get the sense that is primarily a community kind of thing. Duncan's posts are quite brief. They're fairly elliptical. I think they sort of don't make sense unless you know him and his work over a long period of time. They're not they're not meant to be like persuasive to somebody who arrives cold and is like, what is the argument of this piece? Like, where is the evidence? Right. But it's for the fans. And then they talk about, you know, the thing that he's linked to or the point that he's making, and then like engage with that blog roll and other things like that, you know, so it sheds traffic, and it's a smaller number of, in some ways, like more robust blogs, because they are now such entrenched parts of people's lives and their real like internet communities that live for the people to interact with each other. And then a lot of people, you know, who were involved in blogging back in the day have either become professional journalists, have given it up entirely, or are like, there's this like healthy cohort of, you know, like academic people who also tweet a lot when they have the time and when something that's relevant to their field comes up. And it's like a cool thing. Like, you can hear from a lot of people with scholarly expertise in a lot of different manners. And I always thought that was the sort of most exciting thing about the blogosphere, was like amateur media from people who have some real knowledge base that is distinct from like journalistic ways of knowing.
Yeah. When one thing that you've actually kept from the old blogosphere is that you have open threads. And I assume that you're trying to sort of build up a community of commenters. And that's really what, you know, sort of we have been lucky in that respect, and that our blog is big enough to have a robust community, but not so, you know, that there's a certain tipping point in mm-hmm. which a comment section becomes completely unusable. And that certainly happened, you know, to you a couple of times, you know, in your career, you know, and that with a, since I have a day job now, you know, I haven't participated much in the slow, boring comments, but is that something that you've kind of set out to do, or did it just happen? Cause it's kind of interesting that you've tried to sort of cultivate to some degree, a bit of the kind of community that used to be on a blog, and probably because you have paid subscribers, it's not going to be sort of, you know, overwhelmed, you know, and that, you know, paid subscribers sort of solves the trolling problem, right? Because like very few people are actually going to pay.
You know, actually, how many hate subscribers do you think you have, Matt?
You don't generate a lot of hate subscribers. You know, it keeps the numbers down. It's something you can give people and do for them, which is nice. And then, you know, I mean, open, unmoderated discussion at large scale does not work well. The other good thing about paid members is that if I wound up with 10x the subscriber base that I have now, it would probably make the commenting unsustainable, but it would also generate like more than enough money to pay people to full-time moderate in the forum there, you know? So it's like you sort of solve the scaling problem immediately. Like right now, I think it works fine. It works great. I mean, I pay attention to it. My intern pays attention to it. But there's no huge issues there. If it got way bigger, like I would have resources to throw at the problem, which is ultimately what you need to do. You know, you can't just have tens of thousands of people in an unmoderated discussion. Like that doesn't work. And there's a reason that in-person conversations don't happen that way. I mean, it's right. Mostly norms, but like, right. You know, one person has to speak at a time. Like, well, we all know how it functions. People can't just yell constantly.
And so how's your experience been? Like, I know you actually ended up losing money by taking this sort of the initial guarantee, which is not always uh-huh. widely understood, but you're now off, you're now year two, right? So you're getting most of your subscriber money, mm-hmm. you know, kind of without a net, you know, I get the impression that it's worked out well for you, that it seems like a good fit in terms of kind of what you want to be doing and in terms of the autonomy you want to have, you know, are you still, you know, kind of really hopeful about the medium, or are there any issues?
I mean, it's great. I mean, I really like it. You know, I mean, Substack is a company, you know, with venture capital investors and therefore a need for, you know, vast growth. And I wonder, excuse me.
Isn't it?
You know, I'm not sure like how many distinct people are going to be successful on a platform like that, or are we going to see more rebundling? Because, you know, as a, I don't know, like as a media critic, One thing that I would say has happened in the past 5 to 10 years is that we went from a landscape where we used to have a lot of small print publications that were quite distinctive from each other, you know? So the American Prospect existed, and it was a left of center magazine. The Washington Monthly was also a left of center magazine, but in a different way. And Mother Jones was different from both of those. And The Nation was also different. And The New Republic was also different. And so, you know, as a writer, you might know like what you could pitch where based on what the publication was. You could have discussions internally about what pitches you should take and which wouldn't, that were not based on like bullshit, but were based on like we have ideological commitments and certain things are in those parameters and others aren't. The current digital landscape has a lot of good publications that mostly reflect a left of center sensibility because that's what, you know, most of the people working in the field think, but they don't have missions. They don't have ideologies. They're not clearly demarcated to the audience. And they're also not internally, I think like a lot of disputes about what kind of pieces should run currently in the media take on an excessively personal edge because the publications don't have, in some ways, because like people won't just say like, no, we're not going to run that because it's not like, it's not the kind of thing we agree with. You have to come up with like some other reason why it's bad to run a piece or to have people say things. And, you know, that's pushed some people into Substacks and different things like that. And I wonder if we won't see eventually a, you know, reconfiguration of like magazines as they've traditionally been understood, but just out of the bits and pieces of people who are currently writing for magazines or people who are currently off Substacking on their own. You know, I'm still surviving writing 5 pieces a week, but at some point, like I may just burn out and die and like need to have more coworkers.
I mean, that would be fairly shocking, right? After you burning out after all the product. That would be a moment, right? That would be this is the blogosphere died today, right? Is the day that Matt Iglesias hangs it up. Twitter, it does not seem to me, is generating the same sort of generational effect that we talked about at the very beginning, right? Where you have this generation of young journalists who go through this sort of transition from the magazine space to the online space, who find their ways into legacy outlets, mainstream outlets. There doesn't seem to be anything like the incubator that there was at the American Prospect way back when, right? Is there anything like that now? How do people make their way into journalism if no longer through blogs and not really through journalism schools anymore, right? Because those are also having their problems.
I mean, people certainly do journalism schools. You know, I mean, again, this to me was one of the virtues of, like, the Prospect was a nonprofit organization financed by donors with an explicit ideological mission. So they hired young people in part to do, like, low-salaried young people stuff, but in part, like, in order to cultivate newer generations of liberal writers. And so you don't like succeed at something just by trying, but it's really hard to succeed if you don't try at all, right? Whereas, you know, Vox or The Atlantic or Slate, whatever they are, those are commercial enterprises, you know? And so young people come in them and they get thrown at whatever is the sort of most expedient thing to have the lowest paid members of your staff do, which is just not the same as like helping somebody become a well-recognized voice who, you know, improves their skills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a tough landscape for like today's young writers. And there's been a lot of unionization in the sector, you know, which aims to sort of address people's concerns, but it's really hard to write into a collective bargaining agreement, like we're going to take career development more seriously in a real way. Like, you can say we want X mentorship or Y professional development, but it's like, you can make somebody pay you more, right? Like, they sign on the dotted line, your salary goes up and more money will arrive in your paycheck. But like, to make the bosses care about your intellectual development over time, like, that's not the kind of thing you can bargain for. They have to want to do it. It has to be part of the mission of the institution. And I'm not sure we quite have the right institutions for that.
Well, Matt, thanks so much for coming by. Best of luck with your ongoing ventures and navigating the world of COVID with your family. And we hope to talk to you again in the future.
Scott, you shouldn't have given it the Don Corleone, right? Good luck with your new business, as long as you know
your your interests do not conflict with our interests.
It's all good. All right, thanks, guys.
All right, thanks a lot, Matt.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.